Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. Last time, we talked about LGBT issues in prison from a more personal perspective, you know, because the first time around, we talked about it from more of like a statistical perspective. So what we did last time was we looked through the stories of five LGBT incarcerated people and their differing experiences on the inside. Their experiences ranged widely from those who were outed and chose to wear their sexuality openly to those who faced violence in solitary confinement for fighting back on the behalf of themselves and others. For an example of that, there was one individual, I believe, who talked about how he faced solitary for like years at a time during his stay, just because in response to violence against LGBT people, he responded with violence himself. So, you know, it's pretty much like even when you try to defend yourself from violence as an LGBT person, you can be punished for doing so. We looked at the personal perspectives as a way to really understand the realities behind the numbers that we had talked about some time back. In doing so, it becomes apparent just how different people's experiences could be, how different their lived experiences they could be, and how even different facilities create more welcoming experiences for LGBT individuals than others would. There's one facility that was cited by a transgendered individual who was incarcerated, and they basically said that their life there was so much different, because in the previous one they faced a lot of persecution, but in their new facility they had a bunch of welcoming, I guess, environments there, and they actually had a bunch of support groups for transgendered and LGBT individuals. So there is a lot of variation on the individual scale as well. So today we're going to be looking at prison recreation. It's a topic that sounds somewhat less serious than usual, but is actually extremely vital to physical and mental well-being of those on the inside. As a side note, there's actually a lot of super interesting stuff on this topic. It goes way more in depth than I originally thought it would, so this isn't going to be the only episode I do on this. Now, I'm going to begin by nitpicking what I just said. You know, I just said that it was vital to the well-beings of those on the inside. The truth is, it's vital to the well-beings of people everywhere, right? It's not like it's just people who are incarcerated that have a vested interest in, you know, recreational activities. For most people, recreation is the way that you derive pleasure from your free time. You know, you have your hobbies, you have meeting up with friends and family, you have games, you have sports, and so on and so forth. These things are probably what you look forward to most days or weeks. For those of you who find themselves most fulfilled not by such recreation, but by your professional activities, whether that's work itself or work-related affairs, please note that incarcerated people do not have the choice of where or how to work, so recreation is really the main source of physical or mental maintenance and fulfillment on this front. So finding information on this topic to begin with is not really the easiest, just for anyone who wants to dig into this afterwards by themselves, but there is a lot of interesting stuff out there. What I mean by that is most of the interesting stuff happens to be in published journals, which is a big problem for accessibility for the layperson. For those with a student ID or login, most universities purchase licenses to these journals or their papers for their students, either directly or through the university's online library. For those who don't have this option and aren't part of an institution that gives them this access, you can always try to email the authors for a copy of the text. Many, if not most, will actually be pretty happy to do so, because it's not exactly like they get paid by the journals anyways. It's actually quite the opposite. Usually you pay a journal to submit and publish your work, and the journal basically just gets paid by people who subscribe to it. So this is all to say that if you email an author for the article, you're pretty likely to get it from them, hoping that they actually check their emails. I'm going to mainly use three articles that I got for, I'm thinking, the majority of this content, which are Prisoners' Rights to Recreation, Quantity, Quality, and Other Aspects by Robert D. Lee Jr., which was published in the Journal of Criminal Justice in 1996. Second article is Prisoner Recreation, Right of Privilege by Gary W. DeLand, a legal expert, published on the National Institute for Jail Operations, and Correctional Recreation, an Overview by Michael Ryan Alexander of Murray State University, published in 2017. So anyways, with that said, let's get more into it. So per Alexander, quote, there is no federal law providing for mandatory recreation privileges. Instead, the incarcerated often need to turn to the Eighth Amendment, which protects against cruel and unusual punishment, in order to be guaranteed any of these rights. Lee corroborates these claims and explains further. So the rights of someone in the criminal justice system strongly depend on what part of the system they are currently in, you know, or their legal status. When you are being held as a pretrial detainee, you are considered innocent, so you can't put them in any conditions that would constitute punishment. For this, the 5th and 14th Amendments and their due process clauses are used to defend this, depending on whether it's the federal or state slash local governments that you're talking about. But once you're convicted of the crime, most can no longer use these due process clauses. Now, this is when you really have to turn towards the 8th Amendment to look at improving prison conditions. And as a note before we get into this, the 8th Amendment's, I guess, really influence or effect on prison conditions isn't like a static thing. It has changed a lot over the years. It wasn't like people started using this back in the 1700s or 1800s in order to improve jail conditions or anything like that. So there's a lot of change from when people first started using it to what it is today, where people really do turn to it to protect their constitutional rights. So we're going to begin with the story in the 60s. So the 1960s is when courts actually began to use the 8th Amendment to improve prison conditions in general. Now, to begin with, this makes the situation even scarier, right? Because it means that before this time, before the 1960s, which is not too long ago, prison conditions were significantly worse than now, and they're not exactly peachy as is. It's not exactly something that's particularly surprising, but it's pretty odd that only some 200 years after the Constitution's writing were the conditions of the incarcerated deemed worthy enough to receive such judicial attention. But I'll digress. So when this happens, right, when you actually start to get the amendments being used to protect prisoners' conditions, you'd think, great, right? People are finally getting around to doing something about this. Well, what happened in response to that, in response to lower courts actually using the 8th Amendment to provide these conditions, was that the Supreme Court actually became concerned. The Supreme Court. So they weren't concerned about the incarcerated, mind you, but rather that state and local governments were going too far, participating in judicial activism that infringed on federalism. So basically, if you have someone that's actually trying to do something about, you know, prisoners' issues, the first thing that comes to mind of the Supreme Court apparently isn't, wow, we should care about prisoners' issue. It's, wow, we should care about whether or not this follows some odd rules and guidelines for us. Which, to me, seems pretty insane. But as such, it took the Supreme Court another 2 decades, actually, until it favorably ruled on prisoners' rights in the 80s, finally agreeing with lower courts that prisons should have contemporary standards of humane treatment, in their words. In this ruling, they made it so that people had to pass 2 tests, or the Wilson test, in order to evaluate whether conditions for recreation are humane, relying on the 8th Amendment's protection against cruel and unusual punishment. Now, a quick clarification. Legally, humane treatment is not comfortable incarceration. Indeed, under this legal standard, conditions can still be harsh or incredibly deleterious and still pass as humane treatment. For example, when 2 incarcerated peoples were housed together in a single cell in Rhodes v. Chapman, the case in the 80s that established these legal precedents, this was not considered cruel and unusual punishment. To most people, though, a single cell is cramped enough if you had to live there alone, you know, and it's not exactly the nicest conditions either. So shoving 2 grown adults in there would be much, much worse. The specific language used by the court was that the Constitution only confers protection against, quote, conditions that deprive inmates of the minimal civilized measure of life's necessities, which is a very odd judgment to begin with, because you would think that a minimal civilized measure of life's necessities would be enough room for you to at least stand up and walk around a few feet without bumping into your roommate, but apparently not, considering that they ruled that having 2 cellmates in a single cell was fine. And when I say single cell, I don't mean like 1 cell, you know, because you can have 2 people in the same cell provided that the cell is large enough. I'm talking about 2 people in a cell that was completely designed for 1 person. So just imagine like the smallest space with you basically having a bed, like maybe like a couple feet to walk around and like a toilet or something, and then imagine putting another bed on top of that and calling that okay. That's basically what the Supreme Court had okayed. But they did also establish some precedents in that case, and some tests, which are the Wilson tests. So the test that was established from Rhodes, in order to better evaluate these cases, had 2 parts for an incarcerated person to prove, in order to call it cruel and unusual punishment. First, they needed to, quote, suffer serious harm, which was based on demonstrating a significant negative impact on their health. But to begin with, this is notoriously difficult because, well, what constitutes harm? Contrary to what you might think, harm in the common parlance isn't harm in the legal one. And not just because the legal definition is different, but because the legal definition isn't really a definition at all. It's really just defined on a case-by-case basis. Things that a lower court would call physical harm or deterioration would then be reversed in an upper court that called the same thing unpleasantness, not physical harm. This was like a pretty common scenario that happened. In one case, incarcerated people weren't actually allowed outdoor recreation for 5 years, but this wasn't considered harm that resulted in any physical or mental deterioration. In order for an incarcerated person to actually prove harm, the bar is pretty ridiculously high. Oftentimes, you need to actually demonstrate actual muscular skeletal degeneration, cardiovascular deterioration, or another equivalent. But as anyone could see, this is way beyond any normal definition of harm. You know, conditions should not have to get to the point where your body is actively degenerating and visibly degenerating in order to get someone to call it harm. And even after you demonstrate something like degeneration, you still actually haven't proved harm in the legal sense, because the next thing that you need to do is prove that there is a direct relationship between that harm and the specific inadequacy in recreation that you're trying to get fixed. So here's an example, right? Let's say that one problem you have is that your prison doesn't allow showers after recreation. In fact, they only offer one shower per week, and this was an actual condition that happened in a case. And let's say that afterwards you develop an infection like trachoma, which is linked to lack of facial hygiene. You could very reasonably say that the lack of showering facilities led to that harm, led to trachoma, led to your infection. But trying to prove that in a legal way is a whole other beast, you know? People could easily defend this by saying that, oh, the trachoma was due to some other condition in your living quarters, which had nothing to do with the showering unit, so because you can't prove it, we don't have to fix this recreational condition, and we're done. And, you know, then you haven't proven harm, even though to anyone with a brain, there's a clear connection between the two cases. Now, not everything is, like, proving harm to this exact degree, but most of it is. So there are, thankfully, some restrictions that aren't as bad as requiring some big amount of deterioration, but these are rules that are made on an odd case-by-case basis, which makes it a pain to actually decide what a court would constitute as harm, as opposed to physical deterioration. So, for example, there are medical minimum requirements for exercise, which were elucidated by medical researchers. So, for example, there's Kenneth Cooper's research that showed that 30 minutes of vigorous exercise 3 to 4 times a week is adequate to maintain the cardiovascular system, muscular system, and to control fat and cholesterol. Now, in the context of a prison, it starts to get tricky, and works off of pretty bad science, unfortunately. In many cases, courts ruled that prisons need to allow around an hour of exercise a day, so far. Henderson v. Lane stipulated 5 hours per week, which is slightly less. Albro v. Onondaga County stipulated 1 hour a day, and so on. There's a bunch of different cases you can look up in different jurisdictions. But if an incarcerated person couldn't actually show injury or decline in health, courts have actually ruled that 45 minutes a week is okay. So if you can't actually show deterioration, courts have actually showed that all you really need to provide is 45 minutes a week. Cooper's research, remember, said that you need 30 minutes of vigorous exercise 3 to 4 times a week. Even at the lowest bound there, that's an hour and a half of vigorous exercise, right? If you had an hour for recreation, you wouldn't jump right into vigorous activities. Like, let's say you had an hour and a half, actually. Let's say you had that minimum. You don't spend your entire hour and a half doing really vigorous activities, right? You're going to, like, spend some time warming up. You're going to spend some time cooling down. You're going to want to do recreation that you enjoy. You know, how is it recreation if you're actively forcing yourself to get in the minimum requirements to be medically healthy? It's not. It's really just plain survival, which, as we've seen at this point, is pretty much all the court cares about, despite really pretending otherwise, right? They use a lot of language like humane conditions and, you know, stuff like that, but really it just seems like they're trying to do the bare minimum to keep people alive without really making a fuss about it. So my main issues with this idea here right, which is that you can basically ignore the research if you can't show actual injury or degradation, is twofold. And by ignoring research, I mean the fact that some courts are allowing 45 minutes a week if you can't show if you can't like prove degradation, even though research has showed that you need like an hour and a half of vigorous exercise per week. So again, two issues with this. One is that, as I've repeated many times so far, the actual threshold for injury or degradation is pretty damn high, with needing to show actual actual physical, visual, medical degradation. And this doesn't even account for mental degradation due to lack of recreation, which is an often underestimated and undervalued parameter to begin with. When it comes to mental degradation, most courts really tend to side with prisons, not the incarcerated. And this isn't really surprising, considering how we brush off mental illnesses as a society in general, either. But remember that even given our societal preconceptions, mental health issues in prisons are way worse due to a variety of factors. And we previously did an entire episode just beginning to describe mental health issues, so I won't go too far into detail on that. The second issue that I have with this parameter, which is different than like trying to define this harm of like physical mental degradation, is that if you have any kind of population, right, any population of anything that we talk about, if we talk about a population of people, if you talk about like a population of animals, you're going to have statistical variation. What I mean by this is that if a researcher finds that 30 minutes of vigorous exercise 3 to 4 times a week is the minimum for a person, they mean that it's the minimum requirement for a statistically average person. So if you randomly picked some individual, there's a decent chance that their minimum requirement would be somewhat lower than that. You know, as with the converse, there's a decent chance that you'd pick someone that requires even more exercise than that to maintain their bodily state. So if you picked a random incarcerated person, to prove or disprove your point, there's a chance that their bodies wouldn't degrade even with just 45 minutes of exercise a week, even though that would be below the minimum requirement dictated by research. And that's not to say that the research is wrong, but just that your population has some statistical variation. Okay? But here's the problem, right? Prisons aren't ensuring the welfare of just one person. They should be ensuring the welfare of a majority, you know, ideally all, really, of their incarcerated population. But, I mean, considering how little you can get from prisons, I guess that I personally am okay if they could at least ensure the majority of their incarcerated population. So if they were doing so, this means that they should err on the side of caution, providing not only this 30 minutes times 3 to 4 times a week, but that they should actually provide much more than this in order to provide for the welfare of the incarcerated that actually need more exercise. So in this scenario, even without injury or degradation, you should be providing way more than 45 minutes a week. You should be providing not only at least 30 minutes, 3 to 4 times a week, without proving any kind of degradation, but you should be providing much more than that. So what happens is that when courts make their judgments, even when they do take into account science, they often do so in the dumbest, least scientific way possible. And that means ignoring statistical variation in one direction, for example, ignoring incarcerated people that need more exercise, in favor of, you know, really just talking about the other direction, which is talking about incarcerated people that need less exercise. Because if you just talk about ones that need less recreation and less facilities, well, then things are easier for prisons, right? They don't need to provide more recreation time. They don't need to provide more recreation facilities if they pick a random prisoner who tends to fall on the side of the spectrum that, you know, needs less of these things. And exercise time is just one factor here as well. There's lots of different conditions to look at. So for example, direct sunlight, fresh air, and outdoor recreation are all things that some courts have found to be protected in some regard or another. It's not like courts are exactly jumping at the chance to give great access to all these things, but there are at least some stipulations based on that. But again, these are only in some areas. So for example, some courts require that outdoor recreation be allowed, but also ruled that outdoor recreation could still just be limited to 5 hours per week. Now, there's one in Western Michigan that actually did so. But other courts ruled that outdoor exercise is actually not a right for incarcerated people, like one in Western Virginia. Remember that we're still looking at the harm part, right, of the Wilson test. So it's very difficult for the incarcerated person to be able to prove that there's a direct harm that occurs as a result of a lack of outdoor recreation. You have to prove like a direct link between these two things, right? And let's fiat this for a second. Let's say you are able to prove harm somehow, okay? That you are able to prove that because of a lack of outdoor recreation, you have been physically harmed. You'd still need to convince the court of what level of recreation you would need in order to ameliorate this harm. What I mean is, let's say that the court agrees that there's harm. Well, what amount of outdoor recreation would fix that? Is it 1 hour a day? Is it 2 hours a day? What lack of outdoor recreation caused that harm to begin with? Was it because you couldn't go outside for a week? For a month? So even if you do prove that you fit this vague idea of harm, you still aren't really guaranteed to get the kinds of rights that you're looking for. And for like an example here, let's say that you were not allowed to go outside for like 3 months, right? Let's do some pretty high number. Let's say you weren't allowed to go outside at all for 3 months, and you suffer some kind of physical or mental degradation, and you're able to prove that you did this as a result of the outside recreation, as the lack of outdoor recreation. Okay. Then, if you are a court, right, or let's say you're a prison official who's defending this policy, you could say, okay, well then, they only received this harm because they weren't able to go outside for a length of greater than 2 months. You know, so you were originally forced to stay inside for 3 months and you had a harm, and they could say, well, if it was just 2 months, you would be okay. And there isn't really like a way for you to prove that, no, 2 months is still way too long for me not to be able to go outside, because it's not like they're bringing in like statisticians or medical research officials to really decide what the right amount of hours per week is. It's really just up to the whims of the court. And basically, the idea of this, the idea of everything being up to the whims of the court, the idea of every single parameter being so vague as far as what's constitutional recreationally, the idea of this continues to the nitty-gritty of everything. For example, exercise equipment isn't actually constitutionally required by any prison's facility to have. You know, recreation spaces can actually be as small as an incarcerated person's actual cell and still be considered to be constitutionally adequate. In one case, an incarcerated person was actually denied access to an exercise area or recreational area for 28 days, but they were in their cell. And because it was possible for them to have jogged in place in their cell and have done push-ups and aerobic exercise, this was actually ruled to be a constitutional situation. The court basically said, well, you could have ran in place in your cell and done push-ups, so no violation present, you were fine, this situation is all fine. But it's clearly not, right? If you put anyone in that kind of scenario, if you force anyone into that kind of scenario, they'd say, this is insane, why are you doing this? This is some weird punishment, this is some cruel and unusual punishment. But to the court, oftentimes they don't see it that way. And again, remember, there's a lot of this weird variation, which means that your life as someone who's incarcerated is really up to the whims of whatever court is, you know, whichever court has jurisdiction over your area. Like, again, remember that in Western Michigan, outdoor recreation was, like, ruled as a right, but could still be limited to 5 hours per week. And in Western Virginia, they said, oh, you don't need any outdoor recreation at all, it's not a right at all. And then in this other case, they said not only is outdoor recreation not a right, but because you could have ran in place in your cell, that meets your recreational requirements, even if you were in there for 28 days. And so the question then becomes, well, why aren't there any kind of standards, right? This whole time we've talked about how courts have been vague, how there aren't really any standards. And the thing is, some institutions will have standards. But when we talk about standards, these aren't legal standards, you know, they're just professional ones. And what that means is that you're not forced to follow these standards. You're not forced to follow any of the requirements that professional organizations put out. Like, there aren't really any consequences for you not doing so. Realistically, the consequences of not doing so would be that you have a bunch of concerned citizens who come in and protest in favor of the rights of the incarcerated, but that's, you know, that's requiring a lot more than should really be necessary in order to get people the minimum protections that they require. And even then, right, even when you have these professional requirements, the requirements are pretty low. 15 square feet per prisoner was a minimum for recreational areas, for example, as per the American Correctional Association. Like, measure out 15 square feet, and think like, oh, if I was a person, this is enough space for me to be like, yeah, I can recreationally do stuff here for like hours at a time. It's just not gonna work out. And these requirements are made pretty arbitrarily by these professional organizations without really any explanation as to how or why they were set at the numbers that they were. And so now that we've gotten this far into the topic, you can see why there's a lot more to talk about than you'd originally think. Remember that right now we're talking about the harm standard that came out of this one court case. This is one of two standards that you actually need to meet in order to actually show that a prison is giving you a, quote, cruel and unusual punishment in terms of your recreational conditions. Next time, we're going to finish up talking about this standard and go more into the other standard, which, if you're curious in the meantime, is that you have to prove that correctional officials were deliberately indifferent to the rights, health, and safety of the incarcerated individual in question. And in order to prove deliberate indifference, you need to establish that, one, officials knew of this unconstitutional condition, and two, chose not to do anything to fix the problem. You need to prove these things. It means you need to prove a bunch of subjective things in order to have a positive case, which isn't exactly a recipe for success. So for today, we'll leave it here. After we go through legal stuff, there's actually a bunch of interesting research studies, case studies, etc. on the topic, so I'll try to shorten the legal stuff next time so that we can get into a lot more diverse material. This isn't to say that one such material is way more important than the other, but my point is if we spent the entire time talking about legal stuff, as I realize we have today, we're going to be here for a long time. So anyways, as always, thanks for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can always email prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com, and I will talk to you.